You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Between the Acts by Nicole Sperling. Opening photo for this article was by Ryan Schude. Next photos, Taking Notice, Felicity Jones as Ruth Bader Ginsburg in On the Basis of Sex, and Jones and Letter on set. Returning to television, Letter helmed an episode of The West Wing and directed an episode of the final season of ER. She also made Thick as Thieves, a heist movie starring Morgan Freeman and Antonio Banderas that saw its theatrical release scrapped in 2008 amid the recession. Soon the culture figured out what Letter had already discovered. The chasm between television and film had narrowed. She did Smash, Nashville, and six episodes of Shameless. Michael Mann hired her for the epic finale of HBO's Luck. This may sound common, but it's not common, Mann tells me. She has the wherewithal to go and get what she needs from the actor's performance, from the shot, from her edit plan, from her work with music and sound, all to deliver that singular objective. And she does it with such clarity and taste. In 2013, HBO hired Letter to direct the fifth episode of its metaphysical drama, The Leftovers, then struggling for its life. The network approved a hiatus request to retool when Letter's dailies began showing up. Suddenly, Leftovers co-creator and Lost co-creator Damon Lindelof's problems were being solved. Her early years of directing films, coupled with her exhaustive work in television, made Letter the perfect overlap for the Venn diagram for an HBO prestige drama, Lindelof tells me. She went on to direct 10 episodes of the series, which drew an ardent following and became a critic's darling. The Ringer declared Letter the best director on television. Mimi started playing other strings I didn't know were there, Lindelof says. She found the frequency of the absurd. She started working with Justin Theroux to make him a little more tough. She gave the show balls. It is fitting that Letter's return to the big screen would be a Ginsburg biography, especially one that centers on the mid-century gender politics the eventual Supreme Court justice did so much to correct. What Letter has created with On the Basis of Sex is a big, bold crowd-pleaser, the kind of film parents will be thrilled to take children to for its messages of fairness and perseverance, but also one that gets at the intimate, soul-crushing moments when one's individual accomplishments are reduced to tired gender tropes. I'm usually the woman in the room. When lesser men were given the directing jobs I was pursuing, it was hard, hurtful, she says. But my father and my mother taught me never to be afraid, to go forward. I identify with Justice Ginsburg on that. She never stopped. Letter is following her return to film by immediately going back to TV for Apple's much-anticipated scripted morning news drama starring Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston. But she's weighing other movie projects, too. I'm going to make another movie. I'm going to make several more. I'm going to keep going until they throw me out. And they will throw me out because ageism really exist, she says. I'm at the top of my game. I feel so strong. I've learned so much. I've reached this personal moment where I feel very confident, she says, pausing, as if to shake off that learned wariness. Well, I've always felt very confident. Now, I feel like I don't give a shit. Hostile Takeover. Since the 1970s, the DeVos family has been quietly advancing a plan to make government act more like a private business. Sam Tenenhaus traces their outside influence from West Michigan to the West Wing. Illustrations by Roberto Parada. Opening illustration, The Princes. Blackwater founder Eric Prince, U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, née Prince, philanthropist Elsa, and Prince Corporation founder Edgar Prince. And the DeVoses, philanthropist Helen and Amway co-founder Richard DeVos, with businessman Dick DeVos. And all the family members are in a parlor on Friday, September 30th, 2016, Republican nominee Donald Trump made his fifth campaign visit to Michigan, a battleground state, where he was closing the gap with Hillary Clinton. He was scheduled to speak at 5 p.m. in Novi, a suburb northwest of Detroit, but instead of landing at Detroit Metropolitan Airport, his plane continued another 150 miles west to the city of Grand Rapids. The sun was peeking through the clouds over the skyline, one of the Midwest's finest, a harmonious blend of steel and glass high-rises and lovingly restored old stone and red brick buildings, when Trump's motorcade drove through at 12:30 and pulled up to the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum, named for the longtime Michigan congressman improbably catapulted into the Oval Office by the crimes of Watergate. Visitors were startled when a familiar figure in a dark suit and unmistakable orange crown emerged from his vehicle and placed a bouquet of roses, red and white, at the graves of Ford and his wife Betty. School children came racing across the lawn. A local banker called out, "Make America great again!" By the time the motorcade reached the J.W. Marriott Hotel, a cylindrical glass tower on the banks of the Grand River, the press, scrambling to catch up, had figured out what was going on. Donald Trump was in town to meet privately with donors. The cream of the city's business class, manufacturers, Keeler Brass Company, and retailers, Kohl's Quality Foods, gathered in the Marriott Ballroom. Journalists in the corridor outside wondered, would the DeVoses be there? In the solar system of elite Republican contributors, 92-year-old Richard DeVos Sr., one of the two founders of Amway, the direct sale colossus, occupied an exalted place, and his offspring did too. Since the 1970s, members of the DeVos family had given as much as $200 million to the GOP and been tireless promoters of the modern conservative movement, its ideas, its policies, and its crusades combining free market economics, a push for privatization of many government functions and Christian social values. While other far-right mega-donors may have become better known over the years, the Coorses and the Kochs, Sheldon Adelson and the Mercers, Michigan's DeVos dynasty stands apart for the duration, range, and depth of its influence. Start with the think tanks, advocacy organizations, and colleges. In the Grand Rapids area alone, there are three conservative academic bastions: Grand Valley State University, Calvin College, attended by several generations of DeVoses, including Rich's daughter-in-law, Betsy DeVos, 60, who is now Trump's Secretary of Education, and Northwood University, her husband Dick's alma mater. The DeVoses are also major backers of Hillsdale, the libertarian plus Christian liberal arts college in southern Michigan. One celebrated alum, Betsy DeVos's brother Eric Prince, 49, the swashbuckling military contractor who has come to the serious attention of investigators looking into the Trump team's alleged dealings with Russia. Other recipients of DeVos largesse, the Heritage Foundation, the Institute for Justice, and the American Enterprise Institute. The list goes on. The DeVoses don't limit their activism to ideas. They have been enthusiastic supporters of Republican presidential nominees, from Gerald Ford to Mitt Romney, who also has deep Michigan roots. But 2016 changed everything. Betsy, the most visible member of the Klan, had been close to former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. The two shared a passion for remaking public school education. When Bush dropped out of the race, she switched over to Florida Senator Marco Rubio. She also wrote checks for Carly Fiorina, Scott Walker, John Kasich, Bobby Jindal, everyone, anyone but Donald Trump. I'm hopeful we are going to hear something from our nominee to convince me that I should support him, she declared at the time. The DeVos' preference for values-oriented candidates reflect the teachings of the Christian Reformed Church. A small breakaway denomination of its Dutch forerunner, it has some 300,000 adherents in North America, many living in the same western Michigan towns where their immigrant ancestors settled in the 1840s to pursue a faith that combines Calvinist devotion to the work ethic, prayer, a dedication to family and community, and philanthropy. The DeVos's take this seriously. Quite apart from their political donations, they have lavished millions on worthy charitable projects in and around town and far beyond. They have done all this, however, with a flamboyance unusual for Grand Rapids, stamping the family name, or Amway's, on many of the city's most visible surfaces. And now, Donald J. Trump, himself a stranger to charity but not to branding, was in DeVos country. When the Marriott meeting ended and the doors opened, the one lasting image for me, one Grand Rapids journalist would later recall, was seeing Rich DeVos wheeled out of the ballroom to the elevator. Trump had gotten his audience with the patriarch. Some 5 weeks later, on November 7th, Trump and his running mate, Mike Pence, came back yet again for the campaign's last rally at the DeVos Place Convention Center. Trump, it turned out, would squeak through by fewer than 11,000 votes. While the bellwether suburbs outside Detroit certainly helped, Michiganders knew the critical votes that formed Trump's base had come from the western part of the state. The point was clinched 12 days later when Betsy DeVos, in a stylish gray jacket and practiced smile, stood with Trump at his golf resort in Bedminster, New Jersey. She had agreed to be Trump's education chief. The announcement brought Western Michigan royalty into the Trump fold, observed the New York Times. Indeed, when the Senate was split on confirming her, her pal Mike Pence cast the tie-breaking vote. In retrospect, it seemed an early token of surrenders to come, as GOP leaders would make their bargain with the interloper, Donald Trump. Next photos, power trips. DeVos and President Trump at the White House, April 2017, and Prince in Afghanistan, 2009. That was one way of looking at it. Another was that Trump was a useful vehicle for advancing nationally the revolution the DeVos's had already enacted in Michigan. There was, for instance, Betsy DeVos's campaign to undo the state's public education system and replace it with for-profit and charter schools that, as she had put it, 2 decades earlier, shared her mission of defending the Judeo-Christian values that made us what we are, but which are under attack from the liberal elite. There was also the campaign she and her husband had waged to weaken Michigan's unions. And there was the DeVos family-funded gentrification of Grand Rapids, which had erased the haunting images of a once-struggling Rust Belt city, though one beset by racial tensions. Those are some of the lessons to be learned in Western Michigan. West Michigan, as locals call it, as if to designate a separate state, or at least a state of mind. Other lessons can be found in the pulp fiction career of Betsy DeVos's younger brother, Eric Prince, the former Navy SEAL who started Blackwater, the mammoth security company, some of whose civilian soldiers had gone rogue in Iraq. Prince recently turned over his computer and phones to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team, which has no doubt looked closely at his possible involvement in helping establish back-channel communications with Russia for the Trump administration. Prince denies any wrongdoing. Behind all this is the story of a family dynasty that has been a driving force on the far right, the Michigan Medicis of Donald Trump's America. When people in West Michigan speak of the DeVoses, they mean not one great family, but two, joined as the great European noble houses once were, Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, Hanover and Windsor. The story actually begins 30 miles west of Grand Rapids in Holland, a town of some 34,000 on Lake Makatawa that is as reliable a Republican stronghold as any in America. The last time the county voted Democratic in a presidential election, in 1864, against Abraham Lincoln. Betsy and Eric's father, Edgar Prince, was a Chrysler Plymouth salesman and then machine engineer who started a die-cast business and also had a tinkerer's gift for inventions. One, the lighted vanity mirror on the flip-up sun visor, introduced in 1972, helped Prince become one of the wealthiest men in Michigan. Edgar and his wife Elsa were members of the charity-minded Christian Reformed Church, CRC. As he got richer, the elder Prince rewarded his hometown handsomely. Prince money has done much to preserve downtown Holland, which remains a 1950s time capsule of Candyland facades. Elizabeth Betsy Prince, the eldest of four, there are two other daughters, Emily and Eileen, attended Holland Christian, a Reformed high school, and then, like her mother, went to Calvin College in Grand Rapids, a kind of finishing school for that system, says Doug Koopman, who teaches political science at Calvin and has served on the staff of several Republican legislators. Betsy was a freshman in the spring of 1976 when Ronald Reagan challenged the incumbent Gerry Ford in Republican primaries. Reformed Christians have a history of political activism, and Betsy eagerly joined the Ford Youth Brigade. The CRC's greatest figure, Abraham Kuyper, a Dutch theologian and prime minister who died almost a century ago, had declared in words the faithful know by heart, "There is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, 'Mine.'" The political message was open to interpretation. Some Calvin grads, including filmmaker Paul Schrader, class of 1968, had protested the Vietnam War, but many others veered right. And when Betsy DeVos later declared that her ambitions with school choice were to advance God's kingdom, she was echoing Kuyper's teachings. After the 1976 election, religion entered the bloodstream of American politics. The born-again Jimmy Carter was one reason. Another was the rise of the Republican right under Ronald Reagan. Among his most avid supporters were evangelicals who combined free market gospel with a counter-offensive against what seemed dangerous secularism. Abortion, affirmative action, busing, and the liberalization of school curriculums. The Princes, parents and children alike, were in the vanguard of the Christian right. Edgar Prince had survived a heart attack in 1972 when he was 42, and the experience awakened him to a more observant religious life at a time when churches were beginning to embrace the culture wars. The enemy was everywhere and growing: the Equal Rights Amendment, the pro-choice movement, and gay rights. The Edgar and Elsa Prince Foundation would become major donors to two mighty organizations, Focus on the Family founded by the psychologist and evangelist James Dobson, and the Family Research Council, led for more than a decade by Gary Bauer, the Christian Zionist, who in 2000 made a stab at the presidency. Ed turned his future and the future of his business over to God, Bauer wrote about the man he referred to as his mentor. Next photos, the Midwest Wing, Betsy and Dick's home in Holland, Michigan, 2010. And this is quite a mansion pictured here on the water. And the couple in Michigan, 1992. The Princes and DeVosses, with neighboring homes in Holland, had effected a merger thanks to the 1979 marriage of their firstborn, Betsy Prince, and Dick DeVos, then in their 20s. Bible-reading jet-setter was the description in a Detroit Free Press profile of Betsy, published once she emerged as a kingmaker in the state Republican Party. She invited friends over to read scripture. She also enjoyed road trips to watch the Orlando Magic, the NBA franchise her father-in-law had purchased for $85 million, appointing Dick president. Betsy DeVos has not responded for comment despite repeated requests to her office. To be a DeVos was to live large. Betsy and Dick own a 22,000-square-foot mansion on Lake Makatawa with a large infinity pool. Betsy was a competitive swimmer in her teens. They also have a place in Vero Beach, Florida. The scale of the DeVos clan's wealth became a source of national wonderment this summer and a punchline for Stephen Colbert after news accounts described how vandals had set adrift their $40 million, 163-foot yacht, the Sequest, which had been docked on Lake Erie. It turns out the family reportedly owns 10 boats. Seen from the snobbish heights of Grand Rapids, the young auto parts heiress, by becoming a DeVos, had made a brilliant leap into the gilded lap of the super rich. The facts are more complicated. Prince Corporation, with its die-casting machines, was a classic Rust Belt factory. But the DeVos family business, Amway, short for American Way, which recruited people to sell soap and household cleaning products, was very different, a kind of high-pressure cult, replete with tent-style rallies, as disillusioned ex-Amway sellers begin to say. The Federal Trade Commission had spent 4 years investigating Amway. Its multi-level marketing approach, in which descending tiers of home operating distributors purchased Amway products and made money selling them, as well as by recruiting new members, appeared very similar to an illegal pyramid scheme. In the end, the FTC ruled that Amway was legal because its entry requirements were modest and distributors were not compelled to buy unnecessary inventory. But Rich DeVos and Amway co-founder Jay Van Andel were also told to stop fixing prices and to clean up their sales pitch, which exaggerated the potential riches. And yet, the company kept growing. As DeVos would later note with satisfaction in his trumpishly titled memoir, Simply Rich, just 4 years after the FTC brought the suit, our reported sales at retail more than tripled to $800 million. In 1983, however, DeVos and Van Andel pleaded guilty to criminal tax fraud in Canada. They paid fines of $25 million. The charges were dropped. Today, the company's biggest market is China, with its legions of go-getters, though authorities there are now giving Amway and other multi-level marketing firms a hard look. There was more to this than slick salesmanship. DeVos and Van Andel were students of Dale Carnegie, the business and self-improvement pitchman, and especially of Norman Vincent Peale, the charismatic pastor at Marble Collegiate on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. He was also a trustee at Hope College, a reformed school in Holland. Peel's radio sermons reached millions in the 1950s and early 60s, when the Soviet Union appeared to be winning the Cold War. The confident declarations in Peel's bestseller, The Power of Positive Thinking, Attitudes Are More Important Than Facts, never doubt the reality of the mental image, infuse Amway's own liturgy. Peel's politics were congenial, too. He extolled Republican candidates and shrewdly made himself into a media brand with his books, magazine, and radio and TV shows. DeVos and Van Andel created a similar empire. In 1977, they purchased the Mutual Broadcasting System Radio Network, paid Bob Hope to do promos, and hired Norman Rockwell to render their portraits in ads in the Saturday Evening Post. Behind all this was an ideology neatly suited to the moment. Just as American manufacturing began a decline, Amway offered the promise of self-sufficiency. Instead of going off with your lunch pail or briefcase to be bossed around by someone no smarter or better than yourself, you were in charge, with your inventory and customers. Selling America, Rich DeVos's signature motivational speech included a tirade against soft-headed college grads, conned by liberal do-gooding dogma to work for the welfare of others. "Nonsense," DeVos sneered. "We provided more welfare than anybody else. We provide employment for 72 million. 72 million? It was pure fiction, but it was also true that within a few years, Michigan's big three auto companies began to slip, while Amway profits were soaring. A fellow pitchman for General Electric had been speaking Rich DeVos's language. The actor turned California Governor Ronald Reagan. He, too, had delivered silken odes to free enterprise, mixed with warnings about the evils of big government. When Reagan got the presidential nomination in 1980, DeVos and Van Andel were two of the biggest donors to the Republican Party and conservative organizations. DeVos became finance chair of the Republican National Committee. Though he didn't help the GOP's image when he called the 1982 recession a beneficial and cleansing process, and later said of calls to increase the minimum wage, "If it's too small, I have a suggestion for you. Get 2 8-hour jobs." By this time, some began to notice how much of Reaganism was coming not just from California, but also from West Michigan. In addition to DeVos and Van Andel, there was the conservative author Russell Kirk, the sage of Mecosta, who lived an hour north of Grand Rapids. He had been arguing since the 50s that federal programs, including school lunches, were a vehicle for totalitarianism. Kirk's wife, Annette, served on Reagan's Education Commission and helped slip language into its famous report, A Nation at Risk, that created an opening for vouchers and tuition credits. Reagan failed in his true objective, to eliminate the Department of Education, but Annette Kirk, who became an advisor to the DeVos's, persevered. Today, about 80% of Michigan's charter schools are privately operated. Another target was labor unions. Amway and the Prince Corporation had no use for them. Now the family waged a public fight. After Dick DeVos was routed when he ran for governor of Michigan in 2006, he blamed his defeat, in part, on Michigan's unions, and began to push for a right-to-work law, weakening the union's economic power and political clout, a pillar of the state's Democratic Party. In 2012, the bill got through, and Michigan, headquarters to the United Automobile Workers, no less, became yet another of the country's right-to-work states. Betsy was waging a parallel battle against the public school system and its unionized teachers. Her weapon was school choice. A state law rewarded so-called educational management organizations, which grabbed up public money to start private for-profit schools. According to a year-long investigation by the Detroit Free Press, rampant abuses followed. Some educators point to charter school success stories in other states where there has been more strict regulation and accountability. In her present job, DeVos has raised school choice to a national cause. She has effectively shut down Obama-sanctioned investigations of fraudulent for-profit colleges, even as she has gone about hiring staffers from that world, including a former associate dean at one such school that settled a $100 million FTC lawsuit for offering its students hollow promises of post-grad success, a la Amway and Trump U. During her 20 months in office, DeVos has pursued the unrealized quest of the Reagan years, championing charter and religious schools, and in effect, dismantling the Department of Education from within. Through it all, DeVos has maintained the composure of West Michigan nice, though many Michiganders are not surprised when the mask drops and something harder shows through, entitlement commingled with Calvinist certitude. Briskly touring Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, after the horrific shootings there, DeVos avoided giving specific answers to questions, even from student journalists. In June, she told Congress that firearms would not be a topic studied by her own school safety committee, created post-Parkland. "So you're studying gun violence," remarked Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy incredulously, "but not considering the roles of guns?" DeVos is too busy fighting her own war. Among her big accomplishments, says Diane Ravitch, the NYU professor and respected education historian, have been reversing civil rights enforcement for kids with disabilities, putting administrators from for-profit colleges in charge of monitoring for-profit colleges, stabbing in the back young people with heavy debt for their college education, and being a constant critic of public schools. One saving grace, Ravitch contends, is that DeVos has gotten very few of her budget proposals through Congress. There is a method here, or more precisely, a mission. Samuel Abrams, director of Columbia University's National Center for the Study of Privatization in Education, says that DeVos has used her position as a bully pulpit to advance the belief that society doesn't exist, only individuals and families. We accordingly should not be surprised that she has pushed for minimum standards at public school and cut funds for everything from career and technical education to teenage pregnancy prevention. For libertarians, she's a godsend. For the rest of us, she's a wrecking ball. The election of Donald Trump has given us a new gilded age of privatization, profiteering, and self-dealing. Witness the administration personnel feeding greedily at the public trough. Among them, Health and Human Services Czar Tom Price and EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, both now gone, not to mention Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, who last year made at least $82 million in outside income while serving as White House senior advisors. But the most ambitious privatizer in Trump world, with the largest vision, has been Betsy's brother, Eric Prince. Strong-featured and blonde like his sister, Eric was devoted to his father, who doted on him. He played four sports at Holland Christian, and was the proudly straight-laced kid who, without being asked, put away the soccer balls after practice. Prince enrolled in the U.S. Naval Academy in 1987, but was shocked by the frat house atmosphere, too much for a junior culture warrior who'd been an intern at the Family Research Council. After 3 semesters, he transferred to Michigan's Hillsdale College. Today, Hillsdale, under its president, Larry P. Arn, former head of the Claremont Institute, a citadel of far-right ideology, is known as a feeder school for the Trump administration, including Betsy DeVos's chief of staff, Josh Venable. In May, the week Vice President Pence gave the commencement address there, Politico called it the college that wants to take over Washington, citing many alums who are now D.C. power players. The school has received a great deal of DeVos and Van Andel money. "We're rolling in dough," says Mickey Craig, a political science professor at the Van Andel Graduate School of Statesmanship. In the early 90s, Craig taught Eric Prince and came to know him well. "He had that seriousness," Craig says. "It was clear that he just worshipped his father." At the time, father and son, like so many dedicated conservatives, were losing faith in President George H.W. Bush, a moderate. In 1989, Eric had been invited to a youth inaugural ball for Bush, and there he met Joan Keating, the woman who would become his first wife. Prince even worked as a Bush White House intern. "I saw a lot of things I didn't agree with," he later said, "homosexual groups being invited in, the budget agreement, the Clean Air Act, those kind of bills." I think the administration has been indifferent to a lot of conservative concerns. He left that job for another in the office of California Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, who has often been called Vladimir Putin's top Capitol Hill asset, so valued, The Times has reported, that he was given a Kremlin codename. Then, in 1991, after the USSR collapsed, Prince, at 21, joined a group of prominent conservatives who traveled through the Baltic states. One member of the tour was Pat Buchanan, the former Nixon speechwriter and right-wing commentator who was eyeing the presidency. "I was very impressed by Pat's convictions and knowledge," Prince says in an email. "I was drawn to his campaign for a wide range of issues, from trade to taxes. Seeing Bush cave on Read My Lips, rescinding his vow not to introduce new taxes, was appalling." In 1992, Buchanan challenged Bush for the nomination on a platform combining ethno-nationalism with cultural conservatism. His slogan, "Make America First Again," was an early taste of Trump. Both Edgar and Eric Prince were on board. "I volunteered for the Buchanan campaign," Eric Prince recalls, adding that he was a district chair as well. Buchanan now remembers him as one of the most impressive young guys I have ever met. "He drove me around Indiana, spoke at my rallies. Seemed a principled and tough-minded conservative. That he became a Navy SEAL did not surprise me." Next photo, holding court. Orlando Magic owners Rich and Helen DeVos at the NBA's Rising Stars Challenge exhibition game in Orlando, Florida, 2012. Prince spent 4 years with the SEALs in the early 90s, but moved on after his wife was diagnosed with cancer and his father, aged 63, died of a heart attack. The elder Prince left behind a business with 4,500 employees. The family sold it for $1.3 billion, and Eric, at 25, now had a sizable inheritance. A short time later, Prince had a big idea, a new spin on the private contracting business. "I saw how bureaucratic the entire DOD was," he recalls of the Department of Defense, "and wanted to provide a better capability for units that needed it. One of Prince's instructors in the SEALs, Al Clark, was also looking to set up a security and defense training company. Prince had money to invest. Out of this came Blackwater, which began as an instruction facility for law enforcement, the military, and special ops squads in Moyock, North Carolina. In its first years, customers were scarce. This was the time of the peace dividend, Prince explains. Soviet communism had collapsed, and all was supposedly right in the world. And then, in 2000, a Navy destroyer, the USS Cole, was attacked in a Yemeni harbor, and 17 Americans died. Members of the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda and its leader Osama bin Laden were blamed. Soon, Blackwater got its first serious long-term contract, teaching American sailors how to fire M14 rifles. Next came September 11, 2001. The Bush administration drew up plans to strike back, but on the cheap, with some operations outsourced to private companies. In the process, Blackwater secured lucrative government contracts, ultimately about $2 billion in total, promising to train and send teams and supplies to Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. At around the same time, as Vanity Fair would report, Prince was working as a CIA asset, hiring ex-spooks in a clandestine program to find, fix, and finish off Al-Qaeda members. At its peak, Blackwater processed some 30,000 trainees a year, a special swaggering breed, some acting like vigilantes. I had a lot of friends who were PMCs, private military contractors, one former Prince business associate says, and they would come back from Iraq, and they'd tell me, "My God, we know Eric's your friend, but Blackwater is so effed up over there." In 2004, four Blackwater contractors were ambushed and killed in Fallujah. In 2007, a Blackwater contingent opened fire on unarmed civilians in Nisour Square in Baghdad, killing 17. Three Blackwater operatives were convicted of manslaughter, and a fourth of murder. After appeal, the three had their lengthy sentences voided. They are set to be resentenced, while the fourth is being retried. No verdict had been reached as Vanity Fair went to press. The Bush administration had begun to see Blackwater as a liability. Condoleezza Rice, Bush's Secretary of State, singled out the firm for special monitoring. Prince rebranded the company under different names and finally sold it off, relocating to the United Arab Emirates, where he got close to the ruling family and began a new venture, Frontier Services Group, which marketed its security services to foreign states. For a time, he even pondered a run for the Senate, from Wyoming, where his family has a vast ranch. A new era was beginning, and for the Prince DeVos circle, it would eventually open up fresh vistas. The Great Recession of 2008 had left millions without jobs or savings. A tycoon and TV pitchman, Donald Trump, introduced his newest venture, the Trump Network. He called it a rescue and recovery program. To the Associated Press, it seemed more like The Apprentice meets Amway. The resemblances were hard to miss. You could buy into Trump's scheme for only $48, which got you a handy marketing guide and access to a website to promote products. For $497, according to the AP, you could get the kit, products, CDs, sales tips, and coupons. Trump's pitch, it's an opportunity to help rebuild a country, a chance for you to promote wellness and entrepreneurialism, even more, a better way of life. He was also busy promoting his fledgling real estate college, Trump University, Its recruitment drives in Michigan included two at the Amway Grand Plaza Hotel. Trump, like Rich DeVos, was a devotee of Norman Vincent Peale. His parents, Fred and Mary Trump, had been parishioners at Marble Collegiate. Trump's mother, in fact, had won the Peale Award for Positive Thinking in 2000, 7 years ahead of DeVos. Donald adored Peale. "You could listen to him all day long," Trump told religious conservatives at the beginning of the presidential campaign, and Peale had liked him back. "You're going to be America's greatest builder," he'd predicted. "He thought I was his greatest student of all time," Trump once remarked. Eric Prince, as he had with Pat Buchanan, found a new disruptor in Trump, and once again made himself available. In a Breitbart radio broadcast in 2016, Prince joined the fringe of anti-Hillary Clinton conspiracists, at one point accusing her wildly of joining her husband on sprees to an island where underage sex occurred. And today, Prince's influence has been on the rise. His proposal to hire private contractors to run security training for Afghan forces, something that would come from a Bad Soldier of Fortune novel, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has scoffed, has won a hearing from the two new hawks in Trump's cabinet, Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, according to Forbes. And the Prince effect is rippling into other areas, too. Earlier this year, Johnson Cochinchon, Prince's business partner and the deputy chairman of Prince's Frontier Services Group, joined the board of a new data firm. Alongside heavyweights from Cambridge Analytica, the political data mining company, funded by Steve Bannon's old patrons, the Mercer family, who some credit as having been pivotal in Trump's victory. Prince's most conspicuous moment in the Trump orbit, however, came soon after the election. In January 2017, Prince traveled to the Seychelles and met with a Russian confidant of Putin's. One area that investigators have likely explored is the substance of Prince's appearance before Congress last year. "I could testify to at least three or four lies in that House testimony," the former Prince business associate confided to me recently. He pointed to Prince's business relationship with a Russian arms dealer and said that, contrary to Prince's statements, he met with senior executives of the Moscow-based investment firm Renaissance Capital on 10 occasions. Prince, in an email, called the criticism categorically false, saying he had a brief previous contact with a Ukrainian-born arms dealer, but any contact had ended before the window of the committee's inquiry. "As for RenCap," Prince said, "I disclosed all that contact to Congress in the pages of emails I provided them." Guessing at the identity of Vanity Fair's source, Prince characterized him as a disgruntled executive who was fired for underperformance. The source says he resigned after he discovered that Prince had approved plans to illegally weaponize aircraft and actively train former Chinese Red Army personnel that are now being deployed into Pakistan, Thailand, Myanmar, and the Uyghur region in China. Actions he perceived as supporting foreign interest above America's. Other Prince associates reportedly resigned for similar reasons. Prince firmly denied the allegations. "At no stage has FSG ever trained any Chinese official of any capacity, police, military, or other," he maintained. "I have never done anything contrary to American interest and never will, period." When the D.C. Beltway pundits and bitter former employees question my patriotism, I almost take it as a badge of honor. I bleed red, white, and blue. Unlike 98% of Americans, including most of my critics, I served proudly in the military, as shortly will two of my sons. I love my country. I got involved in the Afghanistan debate because I'm tired of America wasting our blood and treasure when there is another way, a better way. The real traitors, he concluded, are those doing everything possible to block and undermine our democratically elected president, and in so doing undermine our national interest. Those accusers should look in the mirror first before throwing lies at me. The tone, angry, even truculent, can also be heard in Prince's congressional testimony. The transcript rawly captures the ideological right in our current moment, straight from the Michigan heartland. Prince, while testifying, makes no attempt to hide his contempt for his questioners, even as he claims they are persecuting him, a blameless patriot and defenseless citizen voter that cares about the wrong direction the country was heading in. It is the same mix of arrogance and piety one can discern in Betsy DeVos as she defies the long-established principles of public education. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.